Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, and I'm here with the Slate Spoiler Special Podcast on Fantastic Mr. Fox, the new Wes Anderson animated movie. Joining me at the movie last night and in the Slate studio today is Jonah Weiner, Slate's pop critic.
Hi, Jonah. Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. So, let's get rolling and spoiling. Let's start with a little bit of a plot summary background on the movie. Let's just start out by saying, did you like it?
I did. I think we both really liked it, despite the guy behind us who was laughing at every single line of dialogue, which usually makes me just hate a movie on principle.
Yeah, that is kind of disquieting, right? It sort of interferes with your enjoyment. I mean, how can you decide what to laugh at if there's just some maniac behind you laughing at everything? But in general, the audience was pretty lively and pretty into it.
They were, and it was also interesting, at least anecdotally, this audience, there were a lot of kids there who a lot of them were applauding at the end.
Yeah, we had two little kids in front of us, about probably 8 or 9 or something, who seemed completely delighted and absorbed the whole time. So I want as closely as possible to recreate the exact conversation we had in the subway on the way home, because I thought it was great, and we pretty much covered anything I would like to do in the podcast. But let's start off first by summarizing the story. It's based on a Roald Dahl, I guess you'd call it a novel, sort of a chapter book that's about, I don't know, 70 pages long or something like that from the early 70s, called Fantastic Mr. Fox. And it's considerably embroidered from that story. You haven't read the book, right?
I haven't.
Basically, there's a lot of adding of characters and adding of adventures and some condensation. There's 4 kids. The Fox couple has 4 kids in the book who are just kind of the nameless Fox kids, and they're condensed into this one son, voiced by Jason Schwartzman. But let's give it an overall plot summary.
Yeah, well, so Fantastic Mr. Fox, I think he just goes by Fox. Did he have a first name, or is he just sort of Fox?
They call him Foxy. It seems to be pretty much all of his name.
Foxy Fox, played appropriately by George Clooney, is this – when we first see him, he's with his wife, who's voiced by Meryl Streep, and they are looting this farm for poultry. They're stealing chickens. Oh, no, they're stealing squab, and they get caught. And Meryl Streep, her character, whose name was Felicity Fox, announces that she's pregnant. And so he vows to go straight. And then the rest of the movie is him kind of breaking that vow and returning to his life of hen-stealing crime.
Right. So that squab scene is basically the prologue, after which you zip ahead. I think they say 2 years later, 7 fox years, 12 fox years or something like that. So time passes faster for the foxes. And George Clooney's character, Mr. Fox, has become a newspaper columnist. He's reading this kind of like Woodland Animals Gazette or something as the movie proper begins. And but he's itching for his old life as a poultry thief and can't get away from his desire to go steal some chickens. And so the next segment of the movie, he does slip back into his life of crime, accompanied by his opossum buddy. What's the opossum buddy's name?
Kylie.
Kylie, that's right, who's voiced by Wally Walidarsky. And so the two of them hold up a few chicken farms. And we should also mention, this is very important to the structure of the movie, that there are 3 big farms located close to the Fox's hole, owned by... Bogus, Bunce, and Bean? Are those their names? Bogus, Bunce, and Bean are the names of the 3 farmers, which is straight from Dahl as well. And they all grow different things. One is a turkey farmer, one's a chicken farmer, and one of them grows apples and makes hard cider, alcoholic cider.
Right.
So these are the 3 things that they're engaged in looting, and these become their 3 archenemies during the course of the movie. So they loot a few farms, and there's some really great high-style heist sequences in this first third of the movie. And then the 3 farmers get together and decide to crack down, that they're gonna rout this fox. And they proceed to dig away his entire hill with 3 tractors, so that the Fox family is forced to dig this underground tunnel. And then there we get some really great animated kind of cutaway-style cross-section scenes where you see the foxes doing speed digging and making this this tunnel structure underground.
Right. I thought that was a reference, among other things, to The Life Aquatic, when we see the sort of the cutaway of the boat that Steve Zissou and his crew sail around on, and they do that sort of diorama, sort of cross section of the boat.
Right.
And there were some similar shots.
Yeah, absolutely. Wes Anderson has basically said as much, but he's really obsessed with tunnels and tunneling and, you know, creating these underground superstructures. And there's some great stuff in this movie with that, which we were surmising has to be drawn animation. I mean, the rest of the animation is stop motion, and I think Wes Anderson was pretty stringent about sticking with old school stop motion animation without computer augmentation. But this has to be drawn, right, when they're tunneling underground.
It'd be really impressive if it weren't. Yeah, I wouldn't know how they'd.
I don't know how they would make the little puppets dig the actual dirt and be moving their paws through the dirt. But I read a piece. We'll link to it on the blog page. But there's a great piece about the animation techniques that were used and the sort of the amount of dolls that they took. I think there's something like 600,000 individual frames that had to be shot for this movie. Wow. So that's how many setups they had to get through, and 500 puppets that had to be sewn in different scales and sizes, and all of that is kind of visible in a great way in the animation that results.
Yeah, well, we were saying on the ride back that there were sort of details that we'd each read about, kind of whether it was these tiny little push pins that had been made to stick in a bulletin board in some office scene, and we'd missed that, or some cutlery made out of, what was it?
Out of deer hooves.
Out of deer hooves that someone holds aloft in one scene. We missed that too. I mean, there's such an abundance of just tiny little details.
Yeah, your eyes kind of don't know where to go in the frame, but it's a very pleasurable not knowing where to go.
For sure. And one interesting thing is that when you talk about sort of the arduousness that's involved in animating a movie like this, what was funny to me was I thought that this had a kind of looseness and spryness that Wes Anderson's movies typically don't. Despite this incredibly painstaking process, through which the animation was made.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know you've written on Slate before that you have your reservations about Wes Anderson's live-action movies, right? And I share them, although I always try to bring an open spirit to his movies because I think he's an interesting filmmaker.
Mm-hmm,
but
for sure.
He's been starting to lose me with the last few movies just precisely because he's such a monomaniac. He's such a control freak about his frames looking a certain way and every texture and every color being perfect. And it does seem in some ways to shut out human feeling, which might be fine if he was trying to make films in which human emotion is not as important as it is, but given that he's also drawn to really melodramatic family stories and, that he likes to kill off his characters and have their siblings mourn them. And I mean, he wants to tell stories that require a lot from the audience emotionally and from the characters emotionally. And yet he always wants to have you at arm's distance in these perfectly aestheticized zones, you know? And it almost seems like, well, now he's found a way to escape that, which is to do stop motion animation.
Yeah, well I mean, I sort of had two thoughts about that. One is that it can get, I sort of found it initially kind of winning and charming when I just first encountered his movies. And you can't help but be sort of taken aback the first time you see a Wes Anderson movie because they are so sort of fully realized aesthetically. But I found it initially winning that he sort of treats characters as though they're just another set of kind of pretty objects in these tableaux of very pretty objects. Sort of over the course of his movies, I found that more and more sort of shticky and irritating, especially because of what you're talking about. You're sort of snapped back to this surface kind of aesthetic reaction when he also wants you to have a deeper emotional reaction.
That really bothered me in Darjeeling Limited, I think, in The Life Aquatic, that both of those movies were about essentially mourning family members, about like the son that dies in Life Aquatic or the father that dies in Darjeeling Express. And yet they all seem to be mainly about luggage and, the texture of curtains and the quality of whatever, like cutlery on a train.
And here, of course, he sort of escapes that. Well, no, he doesn't escape it. To me, it wasn't as bothersome that he treats his characters like pretty objects because they're puppets and they are really pretty objects. And we should just talk for a second about the puppets. They're Mr. Fox wears a corduroy suit cut from the exact same corduroy that Wes Anderson actually gets from his tailor.
I can just hear the Wes Anderson backlashers by the billion rolling their eyes at that detail.
Sure. No, there's plenty to roll your eyes at, but overall I found it just kind of impressive. I mean, just those puppets are just really beautiful. What was it? One thing that was interesting about the puppets was that this goes back to maybe the sort of the stringent realism that he maybe wanted to bring to this totally fantastical world, but the characters, the animated characters' faces aren't wildly expressive. It isn't like an Aardman thing where they sort of have big eyes that kind of, pop out of their skulls and kind of their mouths are just...
No, it's just the opposite. You're really aware at every moment that they're dolls, that they're static figures that are being... I mean, it's almost like he wants to leave the hand in the frame that just moved the doll to a different position. I mean, that never happens, but you definitely have the feeling at all times that they're these stiff dolls that are moving. And so when there's a close-up, for example, he doesn't like them to blink. I was reading about this in the production notes. This is kind of a given in animation, that to avoid your animation looking crappy and like it's just a doll, you have them always moving in some way, even when they're not saying anything. And Wes Anderson didn't want that. He wanted them to be still when they weren't saying anything. I mean, they get movement in the fur. There's that, the fact that the fur is real makes it always sort of move a little bit in the wind. But but essentially you're always aware that they're dolls. And in that sense, it kind of reminded me of the old Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer Christmas special, yeah, which I used to be so fascinated with as a child. And I think what used to fascinate me about it is that they really looked like dolls, and you almost felt like you could reach into the TV and play with them, you know, yeah, and it seemed like yeah, he was trying to get that tactile quality to his puppets as well.
For sure.
Okay, let's take a quick break and talk about our sponsor, and then we'll get back to the movie. As regular listeners know, Audible.com has been the podcast sponsor at Slate for over a year now, and it's a great service. They're offering a deal for Slate listeners right now where if you sign up through our website for a membership, you get a free audiobook, which you can keep even if you don't decide to keep your membership. And the place to do that is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. So we tend to recommend in each spoiler podcast something that Audible has that's thematically related to our movie, and there's the perfect one in this case for this movie. They actually have Roald Dahl reading his own stories, a bunch of his own stories, including The Fantastic Mr. Fox. So if you go on there, it's called the Roald Dahl Audio Collection. There's a bunch of other titles with him too, but this particular title, if you download this one, you'll get all these stories: Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach. I mean, these are basically the big Roald Dahl stories. Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Enormous Crocodile, and The Magic Finger, which I don't know. So yeah, Roald Dahl is a complete pleasure to read, I should say. I reread Fantastic Mr. Fox yesterday on the way to this movie. It takes about an hour to read it, and it's just a wonderful story. So we left off talking about the visuals of the movie, which for me are the main reason to see it. Although, I mean, it is also a moving tale that's well told, but really this is completely a movie about color and texture and, you know, and puppets. And that points at this Wes Anderson division that I wanted to discuss that we mentioned a little bit earlier in connection with The Life Aquatic and so forth, where, you know, you've got this sort of heavy, emotionally heavy subject matter, usually having to do with family relationships. And you've also got this very high level of, you know, aesthetic refinement. And it tends to be the case that your eyes wander off to the Louis Vuitton embossed luggage and you kind of forget about the dead father or whatever you're supposed to be caring about. And so there's a family relationship that's heavy duty and important in this movie as well. And I wanted to hear whether you thought it fell victim to that Wes Anderson problem.
Well, I think that it's a family relationship. Specifically, he's been preoccupied since pretty much Rushmore with this kind of, I don't know, this tension between a father and a son. And I've never really been impressed with sort of Wes Anderson's insights into those relationships. And I thought in Darjeeling Limited, it was just entirely just kind of sketchy. We just hear that the main character's dad has died and they haven't spoken to each other since. And their relationship is just never really unpacked or kind of explored that interestingly. What's funny about this one is that it's co-written by Noah Baumbach, who did Squid and the Whale, which I found was like a really, really kind of wrenching look at, you know, at a just kind of messed up dad and the sons who kind of are wrestling with what they're going to inherit from him. But that said, in this one, you have Ash, who's Fantastic Mr. Fox's son, played voiced by Jason Schwartzman, who's kind of wimpy where his dad was a great athlete and he wants to be a really great athlete, but he just doesn't quite have it. And his cousin Christofferson, who is voiced by Wes Anderson's brother Eric, shows up and is just kind of great in all the ways that Ash isn't. He does this kind of perfect one of the great early scenes establishing his kind of physical, you know, superiority. He does this dive into a bucket of water, and there's this dainty little splash because he just executes it so perfectly.
And the water that splashes up kind of makes a perfect shape.
Yeah, this nice little kind of fleur-de-lis shape.
There's also that great game of whack bat. This is a super Wes Anderson moment. It's like something out of Rushmore, actually, where this sport is invented. There's this sport that all the foxes or all the animals play with each other that's called whack bat. That's some weird combination of baseball, cricket, and I don't know, just insanity that has crazy rules about pitching
track
a flaming pine cone at a bat. And then anyway, it's a very funny scene. And so it's also established that Christofferson is this whiz at whack bat.
He's great at that. And George Clooney's character is too. And Ash just totally blows. And so it's just kind of you set up this kind of tension between Ash being jealous of Christofferson, who Foxy Fox, who George Clooney's character clearly kind of takes a shine to in a way that he doesn't to his own son. But anyway, so you have this kind of tension between them, but I thought here it was just no more than a comic device. It's just for some laughs. We just sort of see George Clooney sliding Jason Schwartzman in various ways, and it's just kind of, we're not meant to care very deeply about it. We're not meant to kind of feel for Jason Schwartzman's character that much. It's mostly a comic device, and I thought that was kind of a perfect level to kind of, you know, just sort of leave it there.
I'm not completely sure how much Wes Anderson did or didn't want you to care about it, because he does. I mean, the closest the movie comes, the most of a concession that it makes to really conventional, sentimental you know, I don't know what to call it, just square filmmaking, is when Jason Schwartzman's character saves his cousin, the one that he's been in this intense rivalry with,
right,
and manages to use his smallness, the fact that he's physically small, as a way to get into this grating and save him. And I thought that moment in the movie was kind of conventional, and that we were supposed to kind of tear up about it. And it was one of the moments that didn't work as well for me. But given that it came in this onrush of really delightful and beautifully imagined chase sequences with great physical gags, it was something I was happy to let go by the wayside.
Yeah. Speaking of the physical gags, just one quick thing I wanted to say is I think I'm sure, you know, commenters or something will tell me if I'm wrong, but this movie features this great dance scene where all the animals have kind of busted into these incredibly rich storehouses of, you know, livestock and stuff that they're gonna eat, and there's this long dance scene scored by Jarvis Cocker, and I thought it was the first time in an Anderson movie that characters have danced, and I really love that. Just kind of, and it goes back to this sort of newfound looseness that I felt in this movie.
It's weird because his movies have such great music, and the soundtracks are so important to them, and a lot of the music is really danceable pop music on the soundtracks. But you're right, characters don't actually burst into dance because that would just somehow be too messy of a thing to do in a Wes Anderson
sure.
movie. But as soon as it's a doll that you have to move into 10,000 different positions to make it dance, I guess that pleases him. But yeah, the dancing scenes are really great, and the dolls move sort of strangely in those scenes too. They're not jointed in a way that's particularly realistic.
No.
And so you're very aware of the puppetry in those scenes in a way that's nice. Let's talk about the ending before we wrap up, because the ending is kind of mystifying. And as you mentioned as we were walking out, it's curiously depressing, or at least it seems to be pointing towards some kind of commentary that's kind of depressing, even though it's also happy in the sense that, you know, all the people that we want to make it, and they're happily dancing in a supermarket full of food, so they're never going to starve. But
right, well, we should say how they get there, right?
Yeah, so, the supermarket.
So the three kind of mean farmers who have just kind of escalated their attempts to get the fox, who's just been stealing from them for so many years, has gone from, you know, dynamite to trying to flood these tunnels that the animals live in, and finally
and staking it out with snipers, so there's like 180 snipers surrounding their hole.
Right, all these snipers and just kind of these insane efforts to try and get them, and they're successful to the extent that they haven't killed any of the animals, but Clooney, and who's become sort of de facto leader of the community of animals, they're all trapped in this like little sewer, and they think that they're just going to starve to death. And then Clooney kind of, you know, saves the day by discovering this one tunnel that leads to the middle of this big box supermarket. And that's kind of the final triumphant moment, is when he says, look at, you know, here, we're not going to starve because of the supermarket. But it's weird, right? And we were sort of having a hard time figuring it out, because what he says is sort of, you know, kind of like, well, the food doesn't taste as good, and it isn't as fresh, and it's full of preservatives and it's full of additives, but hey, it's really convenient. And it seemed like this kind of funny, what I said to you is, this is not going to play well at the Park Slope Food Co-op.
It's an anti-locavore ending. Yeah,
it really is.
And well, because there's also the implication that they're never going to be able to do anything except tunnel between the sewer and the supermarket, right? They're staked out forever. And there was even some moment earlier where the farmers say Bogus Bouncing Bean are staking them out, and they say, well, they have to come up sometime because animals need fresh air or something like that. But,
right,
you know, it's almost like the ending is some kind of affirmation that they don't, and they
yeah.
can live in this completely artificial environment.
Right.
And the very last shot, which in a way is really uplifting, but in another way is strangely confining, is of this really sterile white-tiled supermarket that looks completely different from anything else we've seen in the movie, when everything's been very organic and natural and rich and like ochre-colored. And suddenly they're in this sterile white-tiled supermarket, and they look really tiny. It's a really long shot. And you see these little vulnerable animals kind of dancing on the white floor. It's
right.
weird ending.
It was actually a really sly and really smart way to end it, because you sort of, I'm trying to think of another time when there's been kind of an ending that functions so well, that oscillates between the happy ending and sad ending like that one does.
Well, the whole movie has had this this ongoing theme that the animals are sort of divided between their civilized self, the part of them that can, you know, publish newspapers and create little communities underground and so forth, and the part of them that are just wild animals. And this is said again and again throughout the movie. It's this ongoing theme. There's also a really funny running joke that whenever they eat, right, they're sitting down in their perfectly tailored corduroy Wes Anderson suits, but every time they sit down to a plate of food, they eat it like,
right.
They just snarf it down in a few seconds while growling, and it always gets a big laugh. From
yeah,
the
no, right, right. That's one of the earliest kind of ways that duality is kind of, you know, staged. But right, it does sort of the script posits this split right between kind of the biological imperatives of being an animal and right the socialized kind of comportment that they've whatever, you know, that's led them to wear, you know, corduroy suits and write, you know, newspaper op-eds and stuff like that. And the big climax, the big climactic fight involves George Clooney rallying everyone by saying, okay, you know, you, Badger, you're a really great lawyer, but forget about that. What are your kind of innate species-specific traits and, you know, and skills? And he does that to everyone in the town. And so it's somehow like by forgetting their sort of socialized selves, they kind of are able to somehow beat the – I don't know if there's any real, you know, kind of subtext to that, but it's just it was this kind of weird persistent thing that does seem to feed into the ending in a little way, because there at the end, in kind of having the final scene be them discovering this supermarket, it's sort of they are now kind of discovering and settling into this life that is totally abstracted from agriculture and farming and whatever, and sort of like these animals being kind of divorced from their, I don't know.
But they got there by being their animal selves. So I think Anderson does want to preserve that tension at the end. He must, because it's not the ending of the book. The ending of the book is actually just the big feast that the animals have after they tunnel their way through to the stores of turkey and chicken and so forth. And then you see Bogus, Bounce, and Bean, the thwarted farmers, sitting at the top of their manhole essentially forever waiting for the animals to come out. So I guess
wonder
there's
if
some
it, are they opening it up for a sequel? Because right, because the whole thing, right, the refrain from George Clooney the whole time is, and we should say really quickly, Meryl Streep plays his wife, and I thought that her role was a little underwritten. It's just sort of kind of this stand by your man kind of wife role.
Yeah, the mere fact that we're only saying at the end of this spoiler special, oh yeah, Meryl Streep plays his wife. She should be stealing any movie she's in.
But his refrain to her, she says, you know, my God, like, why do you keep jeopardizing our safety by going out and, you know, and doing these thefts? And he says, I'm a wild animal. So how can we avoid a sequel where the, you know, the inevitable tension between George Clooney being a wild animal, I mean, he's not going to be satisfied by going to the supermarket.
Right. It has to be like Back to the Land, Fantastic Fox 2, right?
Right.
Jonah, thanks so much for joining me for this movie and for this Slate spoiler special.
Thanks for having me.
For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.